So it is the 18th of September, and it is 5 past 5 London time, or 5 past 1 Washington time. And the first question that I would like to ask, please, is about your earliest memory of encountering computing technology.
Well, when I joined the NEH in National Endowment for the Humanities in 1979, I had no personal experience with computing technology. Computers were large hardware units that were used primarily for administrative purposes by businesses, actually. At the NEH, I was introduced to a database of evaluators that the agency was beginning to compile at that time. It was intended to help the program officers select the reviewers and panelists to assess NEH applications. And then shortly after that, the endowment got its first word processing system. And this was actually to help us create grant documents that were had very similar text. So, you know, the same document with changing the address or the letters and other types of documents that were repetitious. And my only other personal experience in the early 80s were when the IBM PCs became available, and then I pretty much just did word processing. My first real encounter with application of digital technology to the humanities was through the projects that NEH supported. You know, I started working in a program in the Division of Research that supported the preparation of research tools, reference works, scholarly editions. And these projects were the ones that were using digital technology at the time. And in the NEH had been funding some of these projects since the 1970s.
Oh.
Primarily, one large text corpus, the Thesaurus Lingua Graeca, which began getting funding in the early 1970s. And other projects really were using computer technology to generate a print product. And that included dictionaries. We supported many of the dictionaries. Mm-hmm. But even concordances to text, which, of course, now it's almost unthinkable to think that mm-hmm. this is a separate, you know, tool. But at the time, it was considered a separate tool, and we funded a project to do concordances to works of Darwin and to the works of William Faulkner, for instance. And then from the output of the computer, they created print products.
Hmm.
Yes.
I understand that you can't you know, sort of speak about evaluation methods or whatever, but I just wondered, in an overall sense, whether the digital component of, for example, of the TLG at that time,
mm-hmm.
Whether that would have been something that was noticeable, or as far as the evaluation of the project was concerned, and how it, you know, in general terms, how those projects may have been sort of received and discussed.
Well, in this program in particular, because the computer was really seen as a tool that would really help expedite all the work that had to be done in order to create the research tool or the reference work, that was a very positive. There was a very positive reaction to use of the computer. The TLG was a little bit different because it was the only one that really was intended to be used electronically rather than to create a printed work, you know, rather than, you know, just to result in a printed work that then anyone could use in a library or whatever. So the TLG, as a strictly a pure database, obviously was a little different, but because it had the support, I think, of the entire field at the time, it was always, you know, well received. And we made many, many awards to that project over time. Now, I believe it probably was 1979, so just shortly after I joined NEH, that the program had a separate set of guidelines for projects that involve use of computers. So this had to be a separate section within the proposal, and they had to address a number of issues about use of the computer. And the very first question was a justification for using computers. So it was so rare, obviously, that within other fields of the humanities that you needed to justify why a computer was necessary for the work that you were proposing.
Is that document still freely available?
That document is available, and I think I can provide you that. I will check, but I think I could provide you that.
Oh, that would be super. Thank you.
That set of guidelines.
Yeah. I think you said, so when you began working for NEH around about 1979, the TLG was already funded, and that program was already up and running by that point, right? I was wondering about, say, how it came about that the NEH started funding those types of programs in particular at what was still a reasonably early stage.
It was an early stage, and I think really it's because NEH has always responded to the field. So, you know, we have open calls. I think you mentioned what that was one of your questions too, whether we normally operate on open calls, and we do. So I think it really was that the proposer was saw this as a need. The field responded. They organized the field to understand the value of doing this work. And it is because for classics at that time, you know, being able to query the whole corpus of Greek was such an important part of the scholarly work they did. Mm-hmm. People were doing it manually. So the very thought of being able to query the corpus of all those texts and being able to come out with the instances where a word was used was just, you know, a tremendous opportunity on the eyes of people from the field. I think anytime we've seen a project that that is essential to the scholarly work of the field, there has always been, you know, an impetus from the field to come and request funding, and the evaluators have always responded extremely positively.
Hmm. And so that would have been, I guess that would have been your first time becoming involved with the sort of humanities computing or what, however we refer to digital humanities kind of...
That's right. So it was really through these projects that I became involved with them. Mm-hmm. I had no special training or connection. I came as a humanist myself to work at any age. Someone who had done work in Spanish literature and language, actually, and had never done any of these. I did not even use any, you know, computer-based projects of any kind or done any of that kind of work.
And when you started becoming active in the conference community of digital humanities, sort of broadly defined, when would that have been?
In the conferences for digital humanities, and at the time, really, the main organization that was having conference, at least here in the United States, was the Association for Computers and the Humanities. And they were having meetings in the 80s, early 80s. I don't know whether I went to an early 80s conference, but my first recollection of going to a meeting is in 1987, meeting that was at South Carolina, and that's because that's where I met with Nancy Ide and Michael Sperbit McQueen, and that made me aware of the, you know, importance of coming up with encoding guidelines, and that started, you know, the opportunity to apply for NEH for support for the text encoding initiative at the time. And we funded the first planning grant them. Well, the first award was a planning grant for them to bring together people in the field. And, you know, I think, I'm not sure there were 30 people there at the time. Mm-hmm. And that was as an international meeting. People who had been doing work in computing to discuss, you know, possibility of working together toward developing guidelines for encoding text in the humanities.
Yeah. And again, was that, you know, sort of making the case for the necessity of funding standards-based work?
Mm-hmm.
How easy or difficult was that?
That at the time, I think, was a little bit different than, you know, the obviously, let's say, the TLG, where you had the whole field, you know, really interested in doing that. That was really a, you know, an awareness on our part that there were lots of people, and the case was made in the applications, and lots of the projects were creating their own encoding standards, their own encoding formats, and that there's a lot of work expended in doing that, and the text could not be exchanged and reused. So for purposes of the review process, you know, that was what persuaded the evaluators and actually NEH to go ahead with that kind of support for something that was a little bit, you know, less tangible.
Yeah.
To support. I mean, after all, you could always, you know, think of, you know, querying in a database and getting results out, and that seemed pretty tangible. The development of standards was a little bit outside of the realm of what we normally did.
Mm.
But the endowment always thought it was important to support tools that were going to facilitate, you know, research in the humanities. I mean, in fact, we even did, before computers, a development of a typewriter ball for Coptic, because, you know, there was no way for people to use the typewriter to create that, so we supported that.
Wow. I didn't know about that. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's, you know, that was just an example of things that, you know, would seem outside of just research tools per se, but they were also tools for the field and anything to facilitate.
Yeah. So there's definitely a longer history of supporting tools irrespective of whether they happen to be digital
or computational. The development of tools, obviously, was for primarily research tools, and that was very early on the history of the endowment, but even before there were separate programs, and eventually they were separate programs to support the focus on different types of activities, and they created the reference of the research materials program that supported all the various tools and scholarly editions and so forth.
Looking back at your time in NEH, the sort of community proposed research themes and more sort of open calls.
Right.
Do you have a sense of the balance between those and the sort of strengths and weaknesses of both approaches?
Well, we have done the types of calls where our focus on a particular theme or goal, and those have been really primarily done in collaboration with other institutions. So if I think of the ones, you know, that come to mind, it's in the early, I think 1999 to 2001, we collaborated with the National Science Foundation in their Digital Libraries 2 initiative because we wanted to ensure that the humanities needs and perspectives were considered by computer scientists doing research, this kind of research. We're still collaborating with the National Science Foundation in a special initiative for documenting endangered languages, in part because both agencies had been doing this for a long time separately, and it seemed like, you know, a wonderful opportunity when it became possible to work together for that effort, and it was an urgent need to do that too, as many of the languages were disappearing. And of course, you know, most recently, you know that the endowment has been working with other international funders to do their digging into data project. Yes. So those, that seems to be most of the work that's done when it's focused. It's some kind of collaboration. We have worked with newspapers quite a bit, and primarily with, in collaboration with the Library of Congress too. You know, the first four, cataloging and preserving the newspapers themselves, the pages. And then now for digitization, we're also working with them. But normally, for most programs, I think, operate on the open call. And I think it's, you know, our sense that listening to the field and been open to what the fields think is important, urgent, results in more productive projects.
Can I ask about those who have been not only especially prominent in the field, but also those who've been quite good at, you know, sort of the canvassing and this advocacy work to communicate with the endowment? The sort of research trends of DH and what they might, what might be considered for funding at a later stage.
You mean particular projects, particular individuals?
Yeah, both. Which I guess whichever you can answer, whichever you are able to discuss.
Well, I mean, there have been some, you know, pioneers in different areas and fields. I mean, I already mentioned the TLG, and Ted Bruner was the lead person then in the 70s and 80s, and he was very, you know, outspoken on the use of computer technology for his field. And not only for what he was doing, but for other areas as well. Greg Crane is well known for his promotion also of computing technology, first for classics, but really actually for the humanities largely. Mm. And then early on in the field of lexicography, there were some people who promoted use of the technology. I mean, notably that I remember John Nitti, who worked in the Dictionary of Old Spanish Language. And he was involved in, with computer scientists, in actually doing the programming first. They had to do everything from scratch because they were working on mainframes at the time, and had to eventually, you know, move everything into microcomputers and so forth. In the for text encoding, Nancy I, Susan Hawkey, Michael Sperger McQueen, those were people who were very outspoken in terms of, you know, the need to come up with guidelines and for encoding the text and ways of archiving the materials that can be reusable, because we can't be, you know, doing this over and over again. And I work a little bit also with people in scholarly editions, and they, two people, Peter Schillingsberg and David Chestnut, were creating scholarly editions in history and literature, and they were working at a time when that was not, you know, use of computers and for scholarly editions was not really the main mode of doing editions. So they were working with the field trying to persuade them that there are some things computers can do for scholarly editor. That took a little bit more, I would say, persuasion than in other areas. In the tool development, it was an easy sell.
I think that actually sort of nicely interconnects with another question that I had about scholars who were not using computers and their research, and the types of views that they may have had about aspects of humanities computing. Did you encounter that from time to time?
In the scholarly editors, in general, I think initially they saw some value, you know, in working with the word processor, but nothing else. And I think that's been a slower trajectory for scholarly editing until people could understand how some types of editions could be rendered electronically. Critical editions, you know, things that involve a lot of collation and different views of a text, it seemed a bit harder to do it in earlier years with the tools that were available. So,
And so do you think that the objection, let's say, or the maybe lack of attention was sort of due to maybe not seeing the possibilities and also the difficulties of implementing the computational work, or do you think there was other factors also involved?
I think there were primarily the challenges of using the technology for what they wanted to do. And the only other issue that happens, I think, across all the projects has been, you know, questions of rights to use the material. And in case of scholarly editions, in particularly the publishers, you know, they had a contract with a publisher, and so the publisher's point of view on how the content might be made accessible also was a factor in perhaps not, you know, putting the making the editions available online right away, because at that point, you know, there wasn't, I think, the subscription mode possibility as fully used as it could be now, for instance. So yeah, I think it would take technological issues and also questions of how they how valuable it was, the technology, for what they needed to do. You know, if they were collating multiple texts and they had to put all these multiple texts, all these versions of multiple texts, was that easier than actually doing this by hand?
Yeah. Those myths about time saving and productivity.
Which was different for the other things. You know, they were gathering, they were compiling information from many different sources to create one new item, you know, new entries and so forth. That's a different use.
Would you ever have encountered, say, I don't know, cultural or social factors, you know, sort of attitudes like the computer is just a tool? Does the computer have a place in humanities research?
Would you repeat that again? I'm sorry. Have I ever what?
Did you ever encounter, let's say, cultural or social factors that might question, you know, whether the computer actually had a place in humanities research and whether it was just a tool and perhaps not something that humanities people should concern themselves with, or had that already abated by the 70s onwards?
Well, I think that, you know, there was a difference between the people who were developing the reference works and research tools, which are the people we're working with, and the people who were working in other areas, historians or literary scholars or other philosophers, who for their own analysis perhaps early on saw, you know, less need to use computers other than word processing at that point. Or maybe, you know, as I say, as some of the online bibliographies and catalogs and so forth came up, started coming out, then they did see value in using it for those purposes, you know, so forth. For doing the research and for creating their the monographs or the articles and so forth, there's a, but as something that would be useful in any other way, I think that took a long time, and even the mindset that, you know, you see now that let's see how the computer can actually allow us, you know, visualize for us some areas of interest, some areas where we can then do some research. And that of course wasn't it at all. There wasn't a sense that the computer was going to teach them anything. It was primarily a tool, yeah. For that part, you know.
I don't know if this is necessarily a question that you could answer, but I just wondered in general about the sustainability of the project that NEH has funded.
Well, that's a big issue, and it has been for a long time, and particularly for the projects that have received multiple awards from NEH, the long-term projects. So we have been actually working with that issue for many years, as we understood that, you know, at some point we could not continue to support all of the continuing projects plus do new projects. Then we started to urge the long-term projects to find ways of sustaining themselves. Some projects created endowments that would help them maintain some of the cost of continually, you know, updating. Because that was one of the big differences, I think, and also in mindset, that initially everybody was so excited because you could update this, you know, resource easily, but then it became a big burden because you never finished this work, right? At least with the print work, you printed it and you were done with the work. Here you had to continue to update that resource all the time. And that requires support. It's, and not only in terms of people, which is the most costly part of it, but equipment, resources of other kind. And we managed to, you know, urge people, and we work with them, we visit them, we talked about them, what are some of the funding strategies you could develop to be self-sustaining and not depend on any NEH funding forever, because it will not be possible for the agency to continue to fund your project in perpetuity. It's a clear message we have to give. And for instance, the classical bibliography, L'année philologique, we worked with them for many years to, you know, make them understand that it needed to find ways of sustaining itself, because their work was they had a lot of bibliographic work that they had to work with, and we helped support that, but every year they had no work to do, so as new publications came up, so it would have been a never-ending project.
Mm. And in general, our projects, you know, if you think back on that portfolio of projects, say in the early 80s, I know naturally some, because of sort of life cycle, that some wouldn't tend to be sustainable in any case, but sort of in a general sense, have relevant projects been able to make that shift?
Well, they have to a great extent. Some of the early ones have done that. They, well, TLG is a good example. They continue to, I think they're over 40 years now in existence, and they have, you know, gotten the institutional support, the support from the field, the endowment, plus other for subscription that I think they still have in part for part of their database, and that has helped them maintain themselves over these many years. With other projects, the institutions have taken that responsibility, and often it's an international effort as well. But it is a struggle for some projects, and it means that someone needs to be constantly not only fundraising or, you know, thinking of new ways of doing things more efficiently, you know, or partnering with other people. And we encourage them to do all of that, because while it's always, you know, good to have projects that have a track record of being useful to the field at some point, it is impossible to support everything. So,
yeah.
And I think I must say that I'm looking at, I have a list of projects that we have supported since 1967, I believe. And also another list of, databases and other computer tools that we have supported from 1967 to 1990. And I was, you know, pleasantly surprised to look at these, check these projects on the web and see whether some of these are still around, and they are. Wow. For the most part, either they, in some cases they just resulted in print works, but many of them, some of these databases are actually still accessible. They have migrated, and they continue to be accessible. I actually this was an interesting thing for me, because you would think that after so many years, some of these projects would have disappeared.
You would, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that list available online?
Sure, yeah. I can provide you with a copy of that list.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank
Actually,
you.
Actually, this is what is interesting about it is that we see a range of the old technologies, all obsolete now, obviously, that were used at the time to create these databases. So I can certainly provide you with a database list and
the
guidelines. That
the database and the guidelines, yeah, that's it. I have two more questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
Yep. So the first is, the sort of movement of people in and out of projects and maybe in and out of the digital humanities research scene. Would you have observed any trends to do with that over the years?
Can you repeat that again? Is it the movement of people or?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, did you know, people who had work funded, did they tend to sort of stay in the field, or do we see that because of the nature of project funding that you may see people being quite active in the 70s and then maybe they disappear and go to another, say, even industry or just to give you a bit of background, I've also been doing an analysis of the publishing patterns in CHOM and LLC, and so it's interesting to see people pop up for a little while and then disappear. And I just wondered if you would
some people who actually move into working on industry, but in general I would say that they stay in academia or in education for the most part, even though they may not be working any longer on that particular project. They may have moved to other, you know, positions in academic libraries or in archives, or I see less movement from academia to the business world, for instance. Some, but not that, you know, everyone who was working in those early days or later days on these types of projects have now moved on to something else. Mm-hmm. They continue to have an interest, maybe not directly on the project they started with, but in other related projects or in other enterprises that have to do with research and education.
Mm-hmm. And then the final question is about the participation of women. Over the time.
Yeah, that. Well, it's interesting. There were some women initially. I would say in the Association of Computers and Humanities. I mentioned Nancy Eyde. I mentioned
Susan Hockey.
But overall, it was a smaller number of women. Now, if you compare it with now, where you go to the meeting of the digital humanities meetings, and you do see a large number of young women involved in these projects. And I don't know whether that has to do with the fact that, you know, in the initial days, it was such a challenge to do any work with computing that was mostly the people who knew how to work with computer sciences and do work with mainframes and then mini computers, and it was when the micro revolution came in and the personal computer that maybe there was more of an influx of women in the field. Among scholarly editors, you know, there were more women, but then again, they were not the most, you know, they were not really using the computer in advanced ways, I would think, with few exceptions, and people who were doing some indexing. And I don't want to, you know, to suggest that there were not people who were ahead of others. It's just that, as a group, I'm talking. There were more people who were involved in systems for libraries and that had to do with bibliographies. Those all things are sort of very natural places for computers to help with all the work they had. You know, this massive work that you would have never been able to do without help of the computer. And lexicography was a natural. You can think of all the manual work that required for the OED or, mm-hmm. or, you know, just to collect all of that individual cards and, you know, try to compile a dictionary out of that. Well, we had a project, the Acadian Dictionary at the University of Chicago, that did everything manually. It started in 1923. And it finished everything manually, actually. Well, not manually. At the end, it was working with computers a lot, but the actual card index was done manually, and it had 2 million little cards.
Yeah. I did part of my PhD was on, and my ongoing research is on historical lexicography.
Uh-huh. So, you know.
One of the, yeah, exactly. The Dictionary of the Irish Language was over 100 years.
Correct. So for, I think it's really on those areas where we saw, you know, that the task was so large that the computer was really a blessing. There's no other way to describe it. That we saw more, you know, more advance, or in the case of classics, I think, because the field had that tradition of, you know, of philology, that inquiry of specific use of words and phrases within the entire corpus of body of text was an important element for the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that there was that with classics and lexicography, that the applications were, I suppose, very, very apparent.
Right. And I think because of, you know, it was a good match, I think, for their need, for the needs of those fields. For other, you know, for historians, well, you know, they are doing they're building argument, they're looking at many differences. It wasn't clear that the computer was going to be a useful tool.
Do you, I mean, we really sort of see a tipping point over the last sort of, I suppose over the last, since the publication of the Companion to Digital Humanities, mm-hmm. is usually being as sort of a, do you remember seeing that sort of, that critical mass build up, in terms of more and more fields sort of saying, ah, yes, now I get it?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think even, you know, looking, for instance, at philosophy first, it was, you know, bibliographic controls, but then, again, tools of the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, that was the first kind of fully online encyclopedia. But more and more, you know, once it became clear that with these different resources, you could, you know, relate them, you could bring them together and create something new, I think people saw the value of doing it for their field. And now everybody wants to digitize.
Yeah.
In part because they feel that if it's not online, it's non-existent.
Yeah.
So from small institutions that have, you know, perhaps unique resources, to very large institutions that have huge bodies of information, artifacts and everything, you know, it isn't anymore a question of making accessible the key things in a field, but all extant evidence, which it's a little mind-boggling, actually.
Yeah, this to think about it. And the dangers of things, whole swathes of things just disappearing because they, for some reason, are not on the web and people don't otherwise access them.
Right.
Yeah. Is there anything else that I haven't mentioned that you would like to discuss?
I know. it's hard to say. I mean, obviously, I think the endowment has managed, you know, over time to work with the field and address the needs as they come. And now I'm pleased that, you know, there's the Office of Digital Humanities that is looking at those other questions of from how technology affects our lives and our the way we do research to, you know, what's the what should be the cutting edge of use of computers in the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been an interesting trajectory for me to watch, from just being at the part where the main focus was on developing resources because there were so few. And now we have this large amount of information, and the focus is how are we going to use it? How can we actually focus on materials to make the better use?